I remember just going back to bed and thinking to myself, I may or may not have been offered a job. I'm like not really sure. And 3 months later, the first restaurant is open and I'm cooking there. The new school.
This is The New School with your host, Christine Hong. Welcome to a new kind of school where we talk about career paths you don't normally get to hear about in the classroom. Every episode, I talk to someone with an interesting life path and learn about how they got to where they are today. Hey guys, happy Monday! I'm your host, Christine Hong. We got such a dope guest for you today. Last year, he was featured on Forbes 30 Under 30 and Eater Young Guns, which highlights the future leaders in the restaurant world. Today, we got Lucas Soon! He is the chef and the culinary director of Gen Z Kitchen, a fast casual Chinese restaurant Vogue magazine has named the Sweetgreen of Chinese food. Today, we're going to discuss how he started his interest in food, how he helped launch multiple restaurants, and what his day-to-day is like as a culinary director and chef. Before we start, just want to drop a note that this interview was recorded before the outbreak of COVID-19 in the U.S. and does reflect pre-quarantine conditions. So when did an interest in food begin for you?
Usually when I speak to journalists on podcasts or otherwise, what people want me to say is that my grandmother was a cook, which is true, and that the passion for food is in my blood, which is also true. But that is by no means the entire answer to the question. I don't really know where the interest in food came from. I'm from Hong Kong. People in Hong Kong like food. We like to think culturally and critically about food. My grandmother was a cook. That was her trade, but by no means was she excited or passionate about being a cook. In fact, one of the first things I remember her ever telling me was, "Don't be a cook." It's one of those things that I've been in the industry basically for 10 years, and it's gotten to the point where it's just what I know how to do.
But I feel like there must be more to that.
Well, I mean, to put it bluntly, I suppose, I think I've always thought that it's important to think deeply about food. Food is a really interesting and easy medium through which to tell cultural stories. It's a really good starting point because if you like a certain culture's food, you tend to like their people. It's a really great way to bring together a lot of sort of modes of thinking and approaches to learning.
Yeah, I feel like Thai food is like kind of people's first foray into anything Thai.
Yeah, exactly. And the more you're invested in that food, the more you're invested in the culture and the people and learning and trying to build a more global mindset and whatnot. That's in no small part why I make Chinese food. I'm really interested in trying to change mostly Americans' understanding of Chinese food. Because Chinese food seems to be this monolithic thing in the U.S. It's like over the last 170 or whatever years that Chinese food has been developing in the U.S., we've come to understand Chinese food as one thing. But really, my understanding of Chinese food is that it's a lot more diverse. It's very colorful. Saying Chinese food to me is like someone saying European food. That's how diverse it is. We have 23 plus provinces. We have 50 plus ethnic minorities. We have hundreds and thousands of cuisines and techniques and ways to cook food. We've been making Chinese food, definitive Chinese food, for at least, 4,000 years. So there's a lot to mine and a lot to explore within that field.
Was there a point in your childhood you realized you were like more into food than the average person?
I don't think I'm more into food than the average person. I think I just chosen it as my industry. I am by no means a foodie. I don't keep up with food news. I don't really care about trends. I just have been eating three times a day, which is pretty average, I think.
Okay, but you did open your first pop-up restaurant at 16
right.
And an abandoned newspaper factory in Hong Kong. So like what prompted that then?
Right. I mean, a good time hanging out, teaching my friends how to cook, serving people, being able to tell stories through food. Yeah, you might be true. That might all be a lie. It's just, there's a writer and a potter called Edmund Duval, and he spoke at school once. So he says, every artist is basically a poet. It just so happens that my form of poetry is pottery. So sometimes I feel like that, like you just go about the world trying to investigate the world and understand more about it. So happens your medium is food and your medium is cooking. I think my career in food is an inclination for curiosity about culture, I suppose. And perhaps the question that I've set out to answer in the last couple of years is, why is Chinese food so good? Like, why is Chinese food so great? And why doesn't it get the recognition that it deserves?
Okay, so I was wondering though, like, I mean, making a pop-up restaurant takes a lot of effort. You have to assemble waitresses, get people to show up. Mm-hmm. I'm in the midst of doing that right now with my roommate because he's really mm-hmm. into cooking. And I was like, you should mm-hmm. open a pop-up restaurant at our house. I mean, it takes a lot of time. So was it just kind of like, oh yeah, I just want to do it. It seems fun. Or what, did you have any hidden purpose in it?
There was no hidden purpose. It was more like a why not type of thing. I was doing it in high school and it all started because I was hanging with my dad. And I was 16 at the time, and it was my last summer in Hong Kong. And he was like, what do you want to do this summer? And I said, I don't know what I want to do. He said, why don't you open a restaurant? And my thought was, yeah, why don't you? Like, why wouldn't you? And we just went ahead and did it. And what's really fun about pop-up restaurants in particular is that the process for putting a pop-up restaurant together is often quite haphazard. It's bootstrappy, and it's kind of step-by-step. You roll up your sleeves, and you just do it and you make it happen. You don't know your obstacles until you come across of them, which is a wonderful feeling. It causes your cooking to be a little bit more creative and reckless than in a restaurant setting because you're beholden to nobody in a pop-up restaurant, basically. There often isn't even an expressive need to make a lot of money. It's a fun little type of business model and a project that is also most of the time illegal, but a lot of fun to try.
Yeah. How did you decide what's on the menu?
It just seemed easier to cook the food that you knew. So I invented this idea for a cuisine called Hong Kong cuisine. Hong Kong cuisine, not Cantonese cuisine, but Hong Kong cuisine as in Hong Kong food that's an amalgamation of all the influences that Hong Kong had absorbed over the years, whether through British colonization or the Japanese occupation or an affinity for Korea or, you know, American influence or capitalism or whatever. And so the cuisine in Hong Kong was a weird mix that was very homey and felt real and authentic to me. So that's how we started, was cooking this Hong Kong style cuisine. Okay. A really good example is, for whatever reason, a lot of families would eat at home, would eat pan-fried codfish with teriyaki sauce. And the codfish usually would be bought from a Western supermarket and it would be frozen. And it would often be imported from somewhere in Europe. The teriyaki sauce would be a Japanese brand from Japan in a bottle ready to go. And the way they butchered this fish, they cut the fish into steaks, but what's the word? Dorsolaterally, straight through the spine. And it's a very odd way of cutting fish that is popular in Europe with the Japanese sauce pan-fried in peanut oil, which is a sort of Cantonese oil, in a Hong Kong home. And you know, that's the type of thing that was kind of interesting and odd. But that's the type of food we used to serve at the first pop-up, called Bozai, B-O-Z-A-I, back from when I was in Hong Kong when I was 16.
Okay, question for you. Yeah. I only know how to follow a recipe online and like step-by-step exactly. So mm-hmm. I'd never really made my own recipe. What was kind of the first original recipe you really felt like was your own?
There is no such thing as originality. There's no such thing as authenticity. There's no such thing as making things up. But every time you cook, you know, let's say you follow a Bon Appetit recipe for, I don't know, mac and cheese. And, you know, you taste the mac and cheese when it's on the plate and you're like, oh, this isn't salty enough, and you add more salt. That's like an original recipe. So that's the first step. You believe that you have more control over the situation than a recipe gives you, and you innovate by adjusting things here and there. And you know, all recipes and all cooks learn by learning basic ideas or concepts for recipes, like steps, and then you innovate upon them. You substitute ingredients for other ingredients, you substitute techniques for other techniques, you change the measurement of specific ingredients, for example, you end up making a dish that is different enough that you might be able to claim as original.
Do you have something you remember making that you're like really proud of?
My first signature dish back when I was 16 was clay pot rice. And bozai in Cantonese, it refers to a small clay pot. But it's also bozai as in bozai fan. And bozai fan is clay pot rice. And it's this sort of like Hong Kong, Southern Chinese, Cantonese style way of cooking rice in a clay pot. Clay pots are wonderful because they're semi-perforated, which means that as you're pushing heat into a clay pot, that heat and that steam gets trapped inside the pot with hot air, pushing air through clay. So you have this sort of like lovely, toasty, earthy aroma to the rice without having to, you know, add any ingredients into it other than rice. It's a pretty technical dish, but it's also known as a kind of peasant or rather low-class dish because on top of the rice, you would put chicken or sausages or whatnot that would release their oils and flavor the rice. So it's kind of like a one-stop shop for your meal. And so that was my first signature dish. And we originally had been doing it with pork belly, which isn't super common in Hong Kong. But the pork belly came from me traveling in Shanghai for a little bit before we opened that pop-up and falling in love with Shanghainese-style braised pork belly. So, you know, there's a little bit of fusion there, but that was our original dish. And then sometimes we would make it with taro when it was the winter, just because it was a little bit more starchy and warming. It was pretty good.
For others who may want to try making their first pop-up restaurant, I was wondering if you kind of had a guide.
Well, I mentor a lot of up-and-coming sort of cooks and families and people in general who are excited about opening their first pop-ups. And obviously, the most important thing is to just go for it. It's a little chaotic and it's a haphazard process, but you won't really learn from it unless you go through the motions and you actually do it. That's usually my first piece of advice. I work with the City Seed in New Haven for a program called the Food Business Accelerator, often, which is New Haven locals who are hoping to build their own food businesses and just, hey, my mom makes delicious food. My partner makes amazing sausages. We want to figure out how we can do this in a pop-up style place. People love events. People love experiences. People love things that are odd and special. So pop-ups are really great sort of like experiential activations for cuisine. For example, can you imagine doing a Filipino pop-up in New Haven where most people have not had Filipino food before and be like, oh, cool, this is so cool. This is a great way to learn about the cuisine. So first piece of advice, go for it. If you want to get a little bit more technical and you had aspirations to move your pop-up into something that's a little bit more sustainable business-wise, I would strongly encourage people to start learning how to write up business models. So in my line of work, it's a little romanticized. It seems as if chefs spend most of the time in hot kitchens yelling at each other and like putting food out really quickly, and they have tattoos and everyone's like really sexy. But really, most of what chefs do is kind of boring and difficult and annoying. We don't often get to do what we want to do all the time. A lot of administration work, a lot of writing up your business models, looking at your P&Ls, you know, inventory management, hiring and firing, HR. It's a lot of business stuff. And restaurants tend to be smaller companies than, let's say, a retail operation. So the chef or the head of the kitchen who comes up with a lot of the creative ideas for food ends up doing a lot of these administrative things. So I think people who started in pop-ups who want to build a sustainable business out of it should definitely learn how to do some of those things and learn how to write basic business models and do basic accounting.
Okay, but if they wanted to do maybe a one-time event or a short while, yeah, you need a location?
I officially on the record should say, yes, you need a permit for it. You know, the key here is that once you start charging people for money, you're providing them a service. And if you're opening it up to the public, it becomes a health hazard if you don't keep your food super code. Now, I will also caveat this with the fact that in Hong Kong was one of the earliest cities in the world to adopt a lot of private kitchens because rent is high. Cooks want to cook creatively, but they can't afford to do it in Hong Kong because the real estate is so expensive. They end up doing them in apartments. And so private kitchens and pop-ups are very popular in Hong Kong. And most of them are not fully licensed by the health department. But it started a really important food movement in Hong Kong. So I would say, if you're just serving your friends, don't worry too much about it. If you're trying to build a business out of pop-ups, you should absolutely be figuring out how to get yourself fully licensed and legal and ready to go.
Okay. So for the one you made when you were 16, did you just find a location, create the menu, invite friends, friends of friends?
More or less. Yeah, that's basically how it worked. You taught the people on your team basic skills. We did a tasting menu back then, so the service was a little bit more controlled. So people weren't ordering off a menu, it was they ate whatever we gave them. And then we also, you know, took reservations and all of that in advance.
Anything, I don't know, I wouldn't normally think of that was really hard or anything?
I mean, we're glossing over a lot of proverbial culinary school education here, right? Most of good cooking is just putting food out at the right time, at the right temperature, with the right amount of salt, sugar, fat, and acid. Almost everything can be fixed with salt, sugar, some type of oil, and some type of vinegar or lemon juice or whatnot. So make sure you have your basics down and don't forget those couple of things.
Okay, so you opened your pub restaurant in high school for fun, and then you went to college at Yale and majored in cognitive science. Did you think you were going to continue making pop-up restaurants in college?
I absolutely didn't. I went to Yale under the illusion that I was going to be a philosophy major because my best friend's name in high school was Plato. And then soon after, I met somebody by the name of KTO who was a year below me. And she convinced me to open pop-ups at Yale too. So sort of despite my Yale education, I spent all my weekends cooking in these pop-ups out of my dorm, out of the basement. I was on speed dial for a lot of New Haven restaurants, and I would like help out chefs when I wasn't in class. And I spent all of my winters and my summers cooking in Japan, either at fine dining restaurants or with grandmothers. And that's how I built up sort of my early understanding of food.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. That's why I'm doing what I do now.
Yeah. Like, why did you decide to go intern at restaurants instead of a philosophy internship or something?
Well, it just seemed like the right thing to do because I was already doing it with so much of my time. I suppose it was a genuine interest. I was very much attracted to kitchen culture in the beginning. Kitchens are quite familial terms, fraternal. They feel a little bit like sports teams. Also like special forces units or like parts of the military. They're very intense, sometimes for better or for worse. But there was something very attractive about kitchen culture. And I, for some reason, instinctively had wanted to spend as much time as possible in kitchens.
Yeah. How did you find these first internships at restaurants?
The way they work in the culinary world is they're called stages. And stages are basically unpaid internships. And the way you get a stage is you turn up either between lunch or dinner service or first thing in the morning and you wait outside the door and you try to get a conversation with the chef and you say, hey, I love your food. I'm going to wash your dishes and wash your floors, or I want to cook for you for free. I want to learn how it is. I want to get a job here, whatever it is. And then you work there for a little while during which you size up the restaurant and the restaurant sizes you up. So it's sort of a cross evaluation where you try to figure out whether this is the place for you. And more importantly, the restaurant sort of decides whether you're fit for the kitchen. And that's kind of the tradition and how most people eventually get jobs there. You just have to be able to hang, basically, and you have to fit in well.
Did you even bother contacting the restaurant beforehand, or you just showed up?
Some of them. In Japan, I didn't because, you know, I was traveling through Japan with my knives in my backpack and I just would stop in places and say, I really, really like your food. What can I do for you? But in, you know, places like Hong Kong, I might try to get into restaurants that I really respected by just turning up. Or, you know, if I knew somebody in a restaurant in a place like Seattle, I'd say, hey, do you think you could put me in touch with your chef? I'm interested in spending a little bit of time here.
Why were you hopping around so much instead of sticking with one restaurant for the summer?
You want to see as much as you can. And given that I would only really be able to spend a whole summer at each location, at each restaurant, 3 months is not a long time at all. So why not cut it shorter and just bounce around and go to as many places as possible?
What kind of stuff do you learn?
How to behave in the kitchen, how to make food, recipes, how to knife technique, that sort of thing.
Was there any particular type of restaurants you wanted to work for that you really had a good time in?
Japanese restaurants are really fun. The culture is really crazy. It's super, super intense. I worked at a restaurant called Kikunoi Honten in Kyoto. That's 3-star Michelin. And that place, you would live in the restaurant that you cooked at. So all of the guys lived together in bunk beds. We all showered together. And we worked basically 7 a.m. until 1 a.m., 6 days a week. And it was amazingly intense. It was maybe the hardest I've ever worked. But the camaraderie was amazing because you're living and breathing together. And everybody starts off as a first year as a junior, which means that there's no meritocracy. It's all how long you've been in the restaurant and how hard you've worked.
So when did you know you wanted to work in food full time? You keep saying you just kind of stumbled into it.
I mean, yeah, I thought I was going to be a Japanese chef for a long time. I met my other co-founders at Junza in New Haven. They were doing their PhDs and master's degrees and whatnot at Yale. And then they came up to me and said, hey, we're going to build this Chinese concept. Do you want in? And in the beginning, it was just a Chinese fast casual. And then after I joined the team, it evolved into something a little bit more ambitious and a little bit bigger with a more sort of broad goal of trying to change people's understanding of Chinese cooking. So they convinced me that we had something good going and then it would be exciting to work on it together. So that's how we started working together.
Is that when you were like, I guess this is my full-time job now after school?
Yeah, I know. Pretty much. I, you know, met with them a couple of times. And then after one time, met with him at a coffee shop. And then I remember just going back to bed and thinking to myself, I may or may not have been offered a job. I'm like, not really sure. And then a week after we graduated, I'm working at Jinzi, you know, and 3 months later, the first restaurant is open and I'm cooking there. So, you know, it's one thing leads to the next. It kind of happened quickly.
Yeah. How did you meet the Jinzi founders again?
They came to my pop-ups at Yale.
Nice. So they discovered you.
More or less. I think they had this silly idea of trying to open a restaurant without a chef. And then they were like, wait a minute, we're opening a restaurant. I guess we need a chef. There's a 21-year-old doing whatever he's doing across the street in his dorm. Let's talk to him. Like, okay, let's work together. And that's how that happened.
Nice. So that was the first restaurant you worked on that was more permanent. So I was wondering, how is it different from founding pop-ups?
I mean, it's totally different. As a business, you have business goals. You have the expressed need to accomplish something. In the case of Jinzi, everything we do is to accomplish this mission of getting people to properly understand the diversity within Chinese cooking. So everything you do has to push towards that fact. Whereas in pop-ups, it's just like, hey, let's put good food out there and let's try not to screw it up so people want to come back when we do it again.
So how did you even go about founding this restaurant? What was that like?
Jinzi, you mean? How, yeah. Like founding as in like building it?
Yeah, what was building Jinzi like?
Well, you need a location. You need a team. So you hire a team. You need to find a good place that has good demographics and good foot traffic and whatnot. And then you have to start going about building a menu. And then once you build your menu, you make your food and your recipes, you start testing it on people before your restaurant's open. So you test, and make sure the food is tasty and that people have good reason to come back to it. And then eventually you open, you make a bunch of mistakes, and then you improve, and then you keep going from there.
How did you all even get the money for those?
In the beginning, a lot of it was self-funded, but we also had a small amount of money from the Yale Entrepreneurial Institute because we had gone through that acceleration program.
Oh, okay. They give you funding to help start the restaurant? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds expensive because you had to buy a location in New Haven?
Yeah, you rent a location and you pay for, you know, outfitting the place and renovating and whatnot.
Yeah, what's involved with like designing the food?
My day-to-day job to this day is that I run all the food at all of our restaurants.
Right, because you're the culinary director slash...
Right, right.
What's the difference between those two positions exactly?
Chef is a little bit more creative. The culinary director job is more about building products, especially in the fast casual space. Designing products for fast casual is a little different from designing menu items for a regular restaurant, where you can, in regular restaurants, you might be able to pivot and change your menu almost daily based on the ingredients and whatnot. Fast casual restaurants, the volume is a lot higher. So designing products for that is a little bit more scientific, and it requires a little bit more engineering, so to speak. Developing food products is different from developing dishes. So just because something's delicious doesn't mean that it needs to make its way on our menu. As a culinary director, you make a lot of decisions for what goes on the menu based on data, based on demographics, based on analysis, tests, you know, recipes, food costs, marketing needs, brand positioning. So all of that takes a lot of time. I mean, put it this way, it takes us roughly between 2 and 3 months to launch a product. So if I wanted to put a new pickle on the menu, it might seem like nothing to a consumer, but it takes me quite a bit of time. For a place like Panda Express, for their Chinese New Year special that ran this year, it took them 24 months of preparation. So they had the recipe done 2 years ago, and it's rolling, and it rolled out a month ago.
Oh, wow. Okay, so if it was two separate roles, the chef would be just coming up with recipes and the culinary director kind of picks and chooses what would fit.
It depends on how you like to structure the kitchen. The way I see it is that the chef is more of a creative editorial role, whereas the culinary director is more in charge of, it's closer to operations and it's closer to R&D.
I read there's so much research and experience involved in designing Jinzi and the food. So I was wondering what that was like. Like, what kind of research do you do?
I mean, you're running tests to, well, probably easier to give you an example. Let's say we might assume that given the current climate, that every restaurant, every fast casual restaurant that serves people on an everyday basis should cater to all people with dietary restrictions, let's say. Mm. And let's say qualitatively, we believe that there are a lot of gluten-free people. And a lot of people eat gluten-free these days, and that it's a trend. So in order to verify that, you need quantifiable data. And then you need to demonstrate that there is, first of all, a need for a gluten-free product. So that's sort of quantitative research. On the other hand, you might dive into Chinese cuisine and ask yourself what type of Chinese cooking would fit this gluten-free need. And then you come up with ideas, talk to chefs, you look through recipe books, whatever it is, you find something that's applicable. And then afterwards, you do the tests where you cook that recipe hundreds of times at different scales in different pieces of equipment to find the best way to do it in a way that fits the equipment and the business needs of the restaurant. Let's say if this recipe is something that needs to be made in a pot, but you don't have pots at the restaurant, then you can't make it or you have to adjust it. It goes through those couple of stages until at the end, your A/B test, for example, is that you might test something that's already on your menu that's naturally gluten-free with your gluten-free designed product, and you serve it to, you know, two sets of people and see which one has higher retention rate.
Do you survey them after they try it?
Right. Sometimes there are surveys because you rely on purchasing data.
That's fascinating. I didn't realize it's so much work. Why would something like a Chinese New Year special take, you said 2 years?
So in this case for Panda Express, they had a 8-treasure stir fry. And then the chicken that's in the 8-treasure stir fry is a chicken breast or chicken tenderloin that's sliced into sort of half-inch wide strips. You've been in the supermarket before, right? And you've looked in the chicken section. Nobody sells half-inch thick strips of chicken.
No.
Right? You cut that yourself at home. But when you're Panda Express and you have more than 2,000 locations, your volume for that chicken per week will easily be probably over 200,000 pounds per week. And your chicken supplier doesn't have the mechanism to cut that. You either have to convince them that it's worth investing, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars into a machine that can cut chicken breast into these strips, or you negotiate with another chicken supplier, or you negotiate somewhere further down the supply line to try to get these half inch thick strips into your store. But can you imagine in the same H-treasure stir fry, like Chinese sausage, like you can't get Chinese sausage at any of the major food suppliers. So how are you going to get it in? Are you going to make it on your own? Who's going to cure it? If it comes from a place like China, how are you going to get FDA approved? How are you going to make sure that it produces enough? You know, it's just an insane amount of detail for every single thing that comes into the store.
Yeah. Are you the one who also needs to teach all the chain chefs how to do it?
Yeah.
Do you just write up instructions or do you have to do tutorials?
Yeah. Basically super detailed instructions, SOPs, standard operation procedures, right? Or processes. So yeah, they're basically recipes, but they're super detailed. A lot of them have photos, specific quality indicators, troubleshooting tips. The idea is like, if you had 100 stores and there's only one of you, how do you make sure that the food that you designed is going to be consistent within each store and between the different stores? So in order to do that, that's kind of like the golden question for a lot of fast casual restaurants is how do you get your product consistent?
So how did you come up with what you wanted in Zhengzhou in the end, like after all your experiments and research?
Well, yeah, we did those tests and then we realized like this is the type of product that we would probably be able to serve and would get people to come back a lot. And so we settled with noodle bowls and bings, and they had high retention rates and I think also enough interest. And they also demonstrated enough about what Zhengzhou wanted to do, which is, you know, a lot of people think that Chinese food is all rice all day, but in northern China, it's not all rice all day. So that's why we started with noodles, by just simply saying that the primary base grain in northern China is wheat and not rice. So we wanted to manipulate wheat in interesting ways. So that's how we settled with those two early formats. A couple of years later, in this day and age, you also offer salads and rice bowls. So things have changed a little bit, but that's how we initially came down to what we served.
Yeah. Have you always been naturally analytical, or did you have to learn this on the job?
Perhaps the mindset of being analytical isn't something that you quite learn, but you practice. I absolutely learned a lot coming into the fast casual world as somebody who basically only cooked in kitchens, fine dining or otherwise.
Yeah, I think with certain careers, the hard question is kind of like, how do I get there? I have no idea how to even get to the simplest version of it. But I almost feel like the problem with founding a restaurant is you might oversimplify things. You're like, oh, we're just going to launch this noodle bowl and it'll be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, how did you even know to think to look out for those things, or like think to run the tests, experiments, and what to survey for and what to look out for?
Well, it's important to surround yourself with smart and experienced mentors who guide you along the way, and also to you know, recruit people in your team who've done it before.
But none of you have founded a restaurant before, right? Any of the
When we opened, yeah. But at this point, we our director of operations, for example, Fernando, he's a wonderful guy who's managed 50 Paneras before. My new Sue, who I just hired, used to be the R&D chef at Dig In. You learn from other people who've done it before. Also, it's important, as I said, to stage and, you know, get as much work experience as you can to have worked in restaurants before you open your first one. That's definitely not something that you should overlook because you learn so much on the job. Can you imagine opening an accounting firm but like never having worked as an accountant before? It's a pretty silly thing. And a lot of people assume that food world is simple because I make food, therefore I can open restaurants.
Exactly.
Two separate different things. I think making delicious food is really, really easy. Everyone's made delicious food once or twice at least. But making delicious food 1,000 times a day without looking at it is a lot harder. And so that's what fast casual is about. And to some extent, that's what restaurants are about. They're about putting really good food on the table consistently and generating sort of extraordinary experiences for guests, no matter which context or which segment of the industry you're in.
So you mainly serve Northern Chinese food at Gen Z right now, right?
These days, we're serving more sort of like home-style Chinese food. But a lot of the flavors that we serve are Northern.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering, did you have to do anything to make it more appealing to Americans?
Well, back in the day, the way you would have designed food is, imagine there's this linear scale, right? On one hand is China, and the other hand is the West. And in order to design food, they would have the scale all the way down in China, and then they would slowly edge it towards the Western side. They would end up at a certain point where they said, oh, this is how Americans like it, and that's that. So therefore, you end up with a product, for example, sesame chicken, that is, I don't know, 40% Chinese, 60% Western, and you're like, okay, this is fusioned, it's good to go, it's adjusted. That's not actually how a lot of Chinese cooking is done today. It's less about moving that scale left and right. It's about looking and actually spending time diving into a cloud of Chinese cuisine and understanding that Chinese cuisine is huge and diverse and there are hundreds and thousands and millions of dishes and finding the right dish and you pluck it out and you serve it. You cook it in the way that you have to cook it in the restaurant that you have so that you can serve a significant number of Western guests. It's a one-to-one thing. It's not like let's fuse and put more sugar into it so Americans will like it. Most modern day Chinese chefs, I would say, don't really think like that. They look at the dish and they say, oh, tomato and ink sauce is a great dish. I bet people in the US would love it. And then you make it as is.
You pick and choose the Chinese foods you think you'll be appealing. Yeah. So when did the restaurant become profitable? Like, how does that work?
It depends on the type of business model that you want to run. We like to run ourselves like Sweetgreen or a startup. So, which is to say that it's okay not being profitable for a long time, the same way Amazon isn't profitable, technically. But a lot of restaurants, I would say, in the greater New York area, or at least Connecticut, you would want to see that you'd have your money back in 2 years, best case scenario. Obviously, restaurants make money for themselves, but it doesn't pay for the overhead of the staff or our headquarters.
So 60% of new restaurants fail within the first year, right? Why do you think you guys succeeded?
Why have we not failed? I would argue that not failing is a pretty slim way to define success. I think we came at the right time. Doing Chinese food, making Chinese food is important, and now is the best time to do it. New York in particular is a wonderful community of recent immigrants who are opening Chinese restaurants for very different reasons from past generations. It's a creative and supportive community. People are able to understand and excited to eat Chinese food, which is all great. So I think we came at the right time. But also, I wouldn't want to downplay the hard work of my coworkers and our staff who are saying that Chinese food should be eaten on a daily basis, not just Chinese food should be eaten. But we are one of the few Chinese fast casual restaurants out there, which makes it a special type of restaurant.
Yeah. What do you call yourself now? Do you call yourself like a food entrepreneur or a chef or a culinary director?
I mostly just deal with the food to this day, so I'm still very much a chef.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering, what's your day-to-day like?
I don't have any preset day-to-days. I don't even have an office, but I do have a test kitchen in one of my locations. I work with my team a lot when they're developing new dishes and, you know, doing quality assurance for existing dishes. I work with the operations team a lot to see what their struggles are. to see if new products can address some of those struggles. I mean, a lot of like branding and marketing meetings, because for example, just as we're doing now, I'm often the face of the company. So every day is pretty different. The only time I really get to cook is for pop-ups and events. So for example, last night we did a intimate fancy dinner for 16 people and I cooked for that event.
Yeah. How do you decide what to focus on for the week?
It's whatever is on my calendar. It's whatever we need to work on as a company.
Okay, so chasing fires, basically.
Sort of, yeah.
Just like, for example, what did you do the past couple of weeks? What were you focusing on?
Recently, I've been really excited about this idea for Chinese-American food. So I'm talking sweet and sour pork, sesame chicken, lo mein, dumplings, that sort of thing. I'm excited about it because we've been cooking it a lot at the restaurant. And recently, we've been thinking about this sort of crisis in Chinese-American restaurants. We do a lot of data analysis, for example. And we found that between 2016 and 2019, the number of Chinese restaurants in New York dropped by 16%, which is insane. And the reason for that is because the number of Chinese restaurants has always grown in the United States, basically since the 19th century. The Chinese immigrants who came here to open restaurants are successful in that they've made a living for themselves and their kids don't have to go back to the restaurants and their doctors and lawyers now. So in a lot of ways, it's a success of the American dream. These immigrants did well. However, Chinese food is also the second most delivered food item in the U.S. after pizza, and these restaurants are closing. So the legacy disappears. And I'm interested in figuring out how to preserve that legacy from a business perspective, from a culinary perspective, cultural perspective. So we've been trying to figure out how we can partake in opening Chinese American restaurants that, you know, can keep that legacy going.
Yeah, that's really cool. You just raised like $5 million funding for that, right?
Yeah, we raised a little bit of money for the restaurant in general, and a lot of the recent investment goes towards this project.
How many restaurants are you trying to help out right now?
We're just starting with the one because we need to build an effective business model and a prototype. And then further down the line, we'll see how effective that one is and whether it's translatable to other units, other locations. Yeah.
I love how you talk because it just reminds me of a product manager for a tech company. Oh. You talk exactly like when, like, we got a prototype, we got to experiment, like, design.
This is nasty lingo that you end up using. Yeah, but you're right. It's interesting to think of food that way. And most people who watch Chef's Table and Netflix or whatever don't often think of chefs as people like that. But I think a lot of the food people that I look up to have developed an acute understanding that the restaurant world in particular is first and foremost a business. So melding business acumen and culinary creativity is the name of the game.
Yeah. Is there any chef who has your dream career?
I'm pretty excited about what I get to do day to day. So it really, in some ways, is a dream career for me already. But I look up to a lot of my friends, especially here in New York. I'm not super familiar with the restaurant world outside of New York and New Haven, but there are a lot of friends that I have in the industry that I wish I could work with more or do their job with them. One of them is a humble little cafe in New Haven called Atticus, which is owned by Chibasso. The owner, Charlie, and the head of communications, Reed. Reed used to work for Jinzi. They're one of the most lovely companies out there. They believe so strongly in their mission. They're doing huge things for the world, for local grain economies, for the people that work for them. And I respect them so much, and I learn from them every time I work with them. They also used to be my number one collaborators when I was cooking in New Haven. There are a lot of Chinese entrepreneurs and chefs here in New York that I look up to. A lot of them I do pop-ups with regularly, and I get to cook with. Eric C at 886 is one of those people. The people behind Winsong, Josh and Trigg and Calvin are also great. The great thing is, I'm talking about all these people who are my heroes, but I know them well. And that's the wonderful thing about the food industry is that everyone's, especially in New York, everyone's just kind of friends. Obviously, it's competitive, but it's never malicious. It's never antisocial.
Yeah, now you sound like a music artist, like collabs of other singers.
Yeah, I mean, that's a cool thing, right? Like, it's what you're saying. That's like, this is the cog side of it. It's like, you can absolutely, as a food person, internalize all of this lingo or approaches to how to do your job well. So yeah, there are no limits. That's the best thing about the food industry. There are very few other industries that have that sort of like balance, or rather that requirement for understanding so many different things, from art and culture to branding to HR to ethics, whatever it is.
What's kind of a good chef or culinary director to you? Are there certain traits you kind of look out for?
Yeah, really great culinary directors have a very acute sense of how to accomplish a mission of a organization or a company and translate that on one hand for the staff and the people who work inside the company and translate that for the guest. So a really great example is like Mark Rosati. He's the culinary director and chef of Shake Shack. He does an incredible job of understanding the needs of the guests that he's serving through things like his form of localization, you know, changing up the menu a little bit, but also understanding that the way they run the restaurants at Shake Shack can really impact the supply chain by doing good through making burgers, by sourcing, you know, buns that are locally made and beef that is ethically sourced. So really great culinary directors have that balance of understanding both what the demand side people need and how to positively affect the supply side of the economics.
That's a good culinary director, you said?
Yeah, yeah.
What about a really good chef?
Chefs absolutely should understand the same thing. Chefs know how to put out great food with their eyes closed with a team of 15 to 150,000 people. Their creativity is applicable and malleable. They know how to translate creativity into something that's, you know, literally palatable.
Yeah. You're talking about a very defined mission earlier. So what do you say is your mission?
I've yet to figure out what the best term for it, but put it this way. So I think Chinese cuisine worldwide, mostly worldwide, is misunderstood. And if we were to see food through the lens of Chinese cuisine, it would make all food better. Which is to say, even if you were an Italian chef, if you looked at Chinese cooking systems, you might understand that woks are actually great. They are geometrically perfect for tossing things like pasta. Why don't we make Italian pasta with Chinese woks? We've done that type of thinking for Japanese cuisine. We've done that type of thinking for French and Spanish and Italian cuisine, but we haven't done it for Chinese cuisine, despite its history, despite the number of people who make and consume it every day. So my mission is to hopefully get more people to think sort of deliberately about what Chinese food can and should be.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so your career hasn't really been like most traditional jobs of a hierarchy of promotions, like senior.
Sure.
Like, I was wondering, what's career progress for you? Do you even think about it?
What's great about working at a startup is that your career progress kind of is tied into the progress of your business and the progress of your organization. I'm excited about Jones to keep growing. I'm also excited to be involved in more and more projects, different types of restaurants, different ways to serve different people. And I have no clear picture of what that even is going to look like 3 months down the road. So we'll have to see.
Yeah. You're featured in a lot of articles now. How do they find you?
I don't quite know, honestly. We have a PR team for the restaurant because it's important to get the word out, because Chinese food is often misunderstood. But yeah, I don't know. You also, in New York, you know a lot of the people who write those articles. Or they come and they hang out, they write an article, and suddenly you're like at happy hour with them. So it's kind of a small world.
Is that kind of how you end up on Forbes starting at 30 and the Gunners?
I'm not quite sure about that. Chloe Sorvino, who is the food editor for Forbes, who wrote the Forbes 30 and 30, somehow had known about me for a while. And one day she asked us to bring her some noodles. So it's like, okay, I'll bring her some noodles. There we are. Yeah, we also interviewed and we spoke for a long time, but yeah, she's great.
Do you randomly get asked to be part of a lot of food ads now too?
I do. I recently was in an Uber Eats ad. I've done an ad for Grey Goose. It's a good time. I like doing ads that mean something. I think actively participating in the advertising world to tell a larger story is a good direction for advertising. It's less cramming products down your throat. It's more, let's use advertising money to say something interesting, which I'm a big fan of. The Grey Goose ad in particular was wonderful because basically Grey Goose came up to me and said, "Hey, Lucas, what's your dream dinner party scenario?" And I said, "I would like to cook in the woods in the middle of nowhere over open fire with no electricity. And I would like to cook Chinese food, New England style, And I would like to forage and cook directly in the charcoals and light fish on fire and shit. And then they were like, okay, cool. We're going to bust you and your friends up to the middle of nowhere and you can do that. And as long as you allow us to maneuver around you with a couple of cameras, you can actually just throw a sick dinner party for free. And I was like, awesome. So that was one of the most fun things I've ever done. And you might imagine that food in advertisements aren't like edible, but that dinner was some of the best food I've ever put out in my whole life.
So what's the best and worst part of being a chef full time?
The best part might be working with other people in your community, getting to cook with different people. The worst part might be that it's hard sometimes.
Was there anything you didn't expect when you went from like making food casually to doing it full time as a career?
No, I mean, not really, because I didn't expect anything, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing you take for granted. Like, anything can happen tomorrow. Shit will always hit the fan type of thing.
Do you have any particular advice for others who enjoy food, who are considering making it a career like you?
I think the most important thing is to eat often and eat with a curious mind and to think about the food that you're eating and to investigate it beyond, oh, this is good. Like, don't stop at, oh, this is good or, oh, this is bad. I mean, it's often the same piece of advice sommeliers give to people who are new to wine. It starts with, do I like this? And then the second step is like, why do I like this? What is the grape behind it? And then what is the terroir? What is the history? How do people make it? And that sort of thing. It opens up all that food has to offer, which is way more than just the food itself.
So what's next for you?
The Chinese-American thing is definitely next. I'm excited to eventually work on different types of restaurants. I have some really great ideas for, you know, full service, non-fast casual restaurants that I'd like to work on. Yeah, but when and how that happens is going to take a bit of time.
Do you have a proudest accomplishment so far in your career?
I was pretty surprised last year when we got an award from Star Chefs in January 2019. Star Chefs is a industry magazine, digital, that gives out rewards every 2 years to up-and-coming chefs. And they called me out of nowhere and said, hey, you got a Rising Star Chef Award. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense because I'm not a fine dining chef. You know, I don't even cook a lot of the food that you guys eat every day. And it was cool because they recognized that even if you're in the fast casual realm, you can be recognized as a chef for your creativity and your work and whatnot. And that opened the door for the other awards I won last year between the Eater Young Gun and the Forbes 30 Under 30 were all surprising to me because most of these organizations don't normally recognize fast casual cooking because it's not as sexy as chefing. And so that was cool. That was really great because most of the time when you win an award, it's more about the community that you get introduced to, the other people in the industry that, you know, are doing similar things to you, and you get to meet a lot of people, and that's just more people to cook and hang out with.
Is there a biggest mistake you felt like you made during your career?
There are plenty of mistakes. None of them are big enough to speak about.
Okay.
But mistakes every day, all the time.
So no regrets?
Yeah. No regrets. Absolutely not.
So this is the end. So I was wondering, is there anything you'd like to pitch for yourself?
Oh, well, follow me on Instagram. Keep up the conversation. DM me. I love talking. I love cooking. If you're in the area in New York, greater New York, hit me up. We'd love to eat. My handle is at lucas.sin, L-U-C-A-S.S-I-N. And the restaurant is Junzi Kitchen, J-U-N-Z-I-K-I-T-C-H-E-N, Junzi Kitchen.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed our interview with Lucas Sin. It was so interesting to meet someone who kind of stumbled his way into a job like that. Really cool. He just kept working on what he was passionate about and then he was discovered. If you're curious about anything he mentioned, we have links to everything we talked about in our show notes. Stick around till the end to hear a sneak peek of next week's episode. You can find more information about Lucas Sin and Junzi Kitchen on our website, thenewschoolpodcast.com. To stay up to date on content, make sure to follow us on Instagram at The New School Podcast. Also, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. If you do, you could find your review on a future The New School episode. If you feel like you or someone else would be an amazing guest on our show, if yes, please contact us on our website, thenewschoolpodcast.com. Also, want your ultimate guide on how to turn your passions into a meaningful career? Subscribe to our weekly newsletter at thenewschoolpodcast.com, and you'll get that guide every week delivered to your inbox.
The New School of Christine Hong is produced by Shristi Biani, Jenny Snyder, and Kiefer Negri. Editing by Sydney Salk, John Simpson, and Joseph Cho. Video editing by Josh Stanley. Special thanks to our marketing team who helps us spread our mission and get the New School name out there. So special shout out to Katie Osaki, Emma Borgerding, Giovanni Cortez, Cynthia Shao, Dina Che, and Marissa Wolfsheimer.
Next week on the show, we've got Janelle Belgrave, who has her own business as a full-time astrologist and acupuncturist. Her astrology advice has been featured in multiple magazines, including New York Magazine, Women's Health, Yahoo Lifestyle, Bustle, Essence, and Refinery29 has even called her their favorite astrologist.
Like, I didn't even know that being an astrologer was a career. You know, people even today, they don't believe in it, and that's fine. They want to disprove it, and that's fine. But I don't think many people have been successful because I don't think it's a science. I think of it as an art. If you know how to read symbols in such a way, you can interpret the art. That's all that it is. I think free will is a very big component in it. So you can't really say this is absolutely going to happen because there's so many moving parts involved.
Come back next Monday to find out how Janelle learned the art of astrology, how she built her astrology business, and what her day-to-day is like. All right, guys, have a great day. Try something new today.